Wonderful. I am so delighted tonight to be able to welcome Judith Black, who's going to be talking about reauthoring your life to Healing Story Alliance and their guests. So, Judith, I'm going to not even begin the introduction because people know you so well, and I'm hoping you'll share a little bit about what brought you to talk about this tonight, too. But the stage is yours.
Oh, thanks, Lani. I'm going to yammer for, 25 or 30 minutes, and then we'll all schmooze together, okay? Of course, you're on Star 6. I can't hear you. I thought it would be appropriate just to start with a short story from my life.
Flight 436 is from Bangor is landing at gate 14.
And I thought, thank God. The woman in the tasteful blue business suit with the matching pumps and the beautifully coiffed hair will not have to share the waiting area with the crazy lady much longer. I mean, the crazy lady would she'd pace like a panther, and then she'd hit the floor and do 20 push-ups and then jumping jacks. And the crazy lady looked over at the beautifully coiffed woman and thought she deserved an explanation. So I walked over. Ma'am? I'm sorry. I know you must think that the outpatients are out in full tonight, but it's just my son's coming home from his first combat duty in Iraq as a young Marine, and everything in that woman softened. I mean, even her suit had less starch. And she looked up at me and said, Oh, my dear. I'm one of the few people who could say I know exactly how you feel. My father was career Air Force, you see. But then the next words out of her mouth, we both knew were a lie. I'm sure he's fine. I'm sure he's fine. I'm sure... I used to work at a place called the Pine Street Inn. It's a shelter for homeless men in Boston. And when I was working there, these guys were the garbage barrel of World War II. They were the men whose hearts were just a little too open for all the mayhem and hell and devastation that poured in. And they could never come back to their lives. They're the guys who flatten themselves against walls, whose eyes can't meet yours, who have nervous tics in their neck. They're the guys, I mean, every war has had them, right? They call it something different for each war. It's a combat fatigue or shell shock. In our generation, we call it post-traumatic stress disorder. Most of us know it from our peers who went to Vietnam. You know, the guys who self-medicate all the time and in the middle of the night suddenly find themselves whacking the person they love most who shares their bed because they cannot keep the image of children burning in napalm neatly in a box in the back of their heads. And now it was my son's turn. People started coming up the ramp. Excuse me, is this the flight from Bangor? Thank you. And I looked and looked, and I finally saw him at the bottom of the ramp. But I didn't scream out because every bit of mother antenna was extended. And I just drank him in. He stood his full 6'3". His shoulders, they were pulled back and strong and steady. His eyes looked straight ahead, big and brown. And he still had that jaunty, I'm king of the world walk. Thank you, God. And I flew. I mean, I flew down into his arms. And he's big enough, I think he probably carried me up. I don't remember anything except that we were talking and joking and laughing. And we were almost out of the waiting area. And I remembered the woman in the blue suit. And when I looked to wave and say thank you, there were tears pouring down her cheeks. I mean, her makeup was just falling in rivulets. I wanted to say, it's okay. I wanted to say, look, he's fine. I wanted to say, see, he's whole. So far. And that story's called Homecoming. when we create stories from our lives, we do it, I think, for two major reasons. One is to integrate our life, that things happen. But what do they mean? Why? You know, something happens, but we don't know why it impacts us. And when we create story from it, we have to ask ourselves that question, or we cannot reshape it for others to hear it. If we just share experiences that happened, we're sharing as we would with friends or with therapists or with neighbors. But when we create story, we reauthor our lives and we say, why did that experience stay with me? How did it impact me? Why does it keep coming back? And for me, that experience waiting for my son to come home from combat, there were only two things that I remembered clearly. One was that I felt like I had drank 12 cups of Starbucks and was ready to jump out of my skin, you know, like wired for electricity, and was really, I mean, really an absolute crazy woman waiting. And the other was the lovely woman in the blue suit and her tears. And those things just kept coming back and coming back and coming back. And if something keeps coming back to you, I mean, whether it's a smell from your childhood or a texture that brings you someplace or a song, it says that that experience has had resonance for you. And it's really worthy of story, of that kind of investigation that is required to create story. So I looked back at it and I said, what was going on? What was going on there? Why were you so crazy? And you never know in the moment why you're crazy. You know, your body tells you one thing and your brain tells you another, and your body wisdom is usually much deeper than your brain wisdom. At least it is for me, and I think for most of us. You know, you get a tick in your eye before you know what's not right. You get these headaches before you realize, oh, I'm miserable. You know, your stomach is in knots before you're willing to admit that you're miserable in a situation. You know, your body has a lot of wisdom. So, you know, my body, even though I had not drunk any coffee, I was ready to dive off the edge of a building. And I had never verbalized why. And so in asking that, I realized, oh, my God, your child has been to war and you are completely impotent. And you are feeling what every mother on earth who has ever sent her child to war is feeling. Because that fear is so constant. This thing happened. I went to see a play at the Huntington, which is a very, as they say, upscale theater here in Boston. And it was about a Cuban immigrant. And I wanted to go because I'd been arguing with a Cuban friend about something. And she said, you just don't understand our people. So I thought, oh, I'll go see this play about a Cuban immigrant and understand better. And the curtain opens, and there is a big fir tree with a Christmas tree with a Star of David on top. I thought, I know this family. And in the very first scene, the son comes home from his second year at Brown and announces to his family that he's joining the Marines so that he can go fight in Iraq. And immediately, I start to shake, sitting there in the dark, thinking, this is not the play I signed up for. Because my son said, he said, Ma, don't bother reading the paper. Don't listen to the radio. I know you don't even own a TV. Ma, I'll tell you what you need to know. And when your child is facing death every day, you try to lock it in a box in the back of your head because you can't do anything about it. And then at the end of the first act, they do a cutaway scene. Now, most of us, because of the field we're in, we know dramaturgy. So they do this cutaway scene, and there is the boy in his uniform, in a Humvee. You know he's over there. And I immediately start to howl like an animal. I mean, I literally cannot control it. I'm howling in the theater, and I can't stop, and I bury my head in the purse. And, of course, an explosion happens, and we don't know if he died or he's injured, but we knew they were going to take him out because, you know, you don't show the gun unless you're going to shoot somebody by the end of the play. So you don't show the kid in the Humvee unless you're going to blow him up. And I'm sitting there at the Huntington, and people are, like, patting me on the back, and they're putting tissues in my lap. They're very nice. They have no idea why I'm howling like an animal. And I can't get a grip. You know, it's just like this thing came out, this very primal fear. And when I got honest with myself, I said, well, of course. You know, that's what you've been feeling, and now he's coming home. And you know what war can do. You've seen it. You know, you've seen it at the Pine Street Inn. You've seen it with your peers. And here's your child. So, and it's only looking back. It's only in the analysis of the experience that I could understand that and then shape it into the story. So that there was a reason for that behavior and a reason that didn't just resonate for me, but something that probably resonates for any mother who sent her son to war. And that's what personal story can do. It can take what has happened to you, and by understanding why and how it's affected you, then touch other people's experiences and allow them to enter it. Allow them to be standing at the top of that ramp waiting for their child or waiting for their neighbor's child or waiting for their, you know, their niece's child to come up that ramp. And the other thing that resonated that had to be there was this woman's tears. Because, of course, she could have been crying for any number of reasons. And when you create story, whatever your reason is for her tears, you'll find that. But of course, I put in mine, and assumed that she was just sharing my relief. But it's interesting because once the story was done and people got to hear it, one woman emailed me and said, "Oh, I'm so proud of our boys too." And I thought, wow, you know, I thought this was a story, an anti-war story. But that's the other thing that happens. When you create stories from your experience and you don't tell people what to think or what to feel, it becomes their template. And that's what she needed. She needed to feel that pride. And so that's what she got from that story. And that's the other amazing thing that happens, because once you've explored the experience, enabled other people to enter it, or universalized it in a way, then they come out with their own meaning. You need yours, but they will find their own. I think the other reason that creating stories from your life is so important is that life happens, but we give it its meaning. So you could retell a story 1,000 times, a story of your own. Let's call it an anecdote of your experience. And every time you retell it, you convince yourself more and more that you were a victim or you were used or you were done to, because you're retelling it that way each time, each time, each time. That's the meaning you got from that experience. But sometimes you can unearth those experiences and change the meaning. The experience is the same. But what do you come out with? So, for instance, I've had the opportunity to teach adults at Lesley University for 25 years. And in the second week of the class, we work on personal stories. And I always say to people, work on something that's unresolved. And don't think, is it funny? Is it sad? Is it meaningful? Don't just that it resonates, that it's something that keeps coming back to you for some reason. And then we're going to dive into it. And we're going to reauthor it. And then, you know, we go through this huge series of interesting exercises that I've developed around this. And in one group, and this was the most fascinating thing, in one group of 6 women, 4 of them told stories about childhood sexual abuse. And because we had taken the time to reauthor it, none of them anymore felt completely like victims. Because we began with, who are you today? What are your strengths? What are the gifts that you give to your world? So that the stories come framed from somebody who is a completely competent, loving human. So something might have happened that injured you, but somehow, here you are today. You know how to love. You know how to give and take. You probably hold some kind of job. Something has happened that has enabled you to not live inside that pain or define yourself by it. So that's you know, where we come to. And one woman told the most painful story about her father, who, when he was drunk, she could hear him, the boots, walking up the stairs, 21 stairs. And when he was drunk, they could always tell by how heavy the boot falls were. And her sister would always come into the room with her. And when he got to the top of the stairs, he'd tell the little sister, "Get out of here." And he would be alone with her. And she would do what so many children who suffer from sexual abuse do. She would leave her body and watch him hurt that little girl. And when he was done, she would go over to the window and pick up a dead bug. You know how bugs die from the heat in the window? And she'd store it in a box. And she said she kept a box with a bug to represent every single time her father walked into that room. Because as she grew, she knew she would never allow her own daughter to collect a single one like it, or any child who she ever worked with. And she grew her life as a teacher, and as somebody who was incredibly aware of these types of issues in kids' lives, and came to their sides to be their advocate. And when she told the story, I'm going to start to cry, she brought a box, and it was gift-wrapped in beautiful paper. And she told us, inside were the bugs, because she never wants to forget, because it gives her strength to protect others. So here was somebody who really, you know, saw herself not as a victim, but because of the work, was able to reauthor that experience. Not that she wouldn't have liked to have skipped it. So here's the other thing that happened in that group. Three other people told stories. One, an absolute comedy about a neighbor who used to flash. He had a yellow raincoat, and he would flash the kids next door, and he was like this really harmless old guy, and the kids were too little to even understand what flashing was, and they'd run home and go, "Mommy, Mommy, Mr. Bernie can't afford clothes." I mean, it was very funny. But what happened in the group is another woman, as these stories were told, and in the beginning she goes, "Oh, thank goodness nothing like that ever happened to me." And as the stories were being told, you saw her sort of, not sort of, melting down. And after the fourth story, she was sitting there trembling. And, you know, we put our arms around her and said, "What is it?" And she said, "Oh, God, when I was in second grade, there was a student teacher." And she told us about these experiences in a cloakroom where a student teacher had done very inappropriate sexual things to her, which she had kept hidden in the back of her brain. And one of the things we know is you can push things back, but just like me sitting in that theater, something will whap open that door and it will fly forward and it will invade your life. And it will get in the way of you having loving relationships. And so she was able to begin to talk about it, and we started to create story for her around it so that she could not live in it but reauthor it and see it as just another experience in her life. I'm just going to tell one more thing. I teach a class. It's the first February of every year now at the house here, and it's called Making Stories from Your Life. And one year a woman came, and we went around, and usually if you're going to give a whole weekend of your life to, you know, to sort of unearth it and reauthor it, you kind of know what you want to work on. So we went around, and it was her turn, and she had this very sweet smile and said, "Oh, I'm just here because I'm interested. It seemed like an interesting thing to do." Okay. So we start to do our work, and it's a full weekend, but after a day, it feels like a week. And she is still in that same place with that little smile. "Oh, this is so interesting. No, nothing really interesting happened to me. I'm just really liking hearing other people's stories and their process." So finally I said, Can I ask you some questions? Why, sure. So I just started to ask her about her life, and she was very sweet. Do you work? No, I stopped working when I had children. Oh, well, what kind of work did you do before? Oh, my husband and I taught ballroom dancing on board ships. Oh, why did you stop? Oh, after I had my first child, my husband said I was just too fat to teach and dance anymore. Oh, what happened? Oh, he took a new dance partner. She got all my costumes. He used to sleep with all his partners. And so it went on with that little smile. And any of us who have been in this field, know that a woman would not be able to live with that behavior unless she had come to expect it all along the way. And so I asked her, "May I ask you about your family, your childhood?" And she said, "Sure." And by the end of the questions, it's clear that she had been sexually abused by her grandfather, her uncle, and her minister. And she's still sitting there with that little smile. So I said, "May I make up a story for you?" She said, "Sure. Let's call her Betty." I said, "Once upon a time, there was a kingdom. And in this kingdom lived Princess Betty. Princess Betty sat on the throne, and the thing she wanted most in this world was for every child in her kingdom to feel safe and loved. They adored Princess Betty, but Princess Betty heard some bad news. And I asked her, I said, 'If your grandfather was an animal, what animal would he be?' She said, 'A weasel.' There was a weasel in the kingdom, and the weasel was grabbing onto the children, and the weasel was digging its teeth and its claws into the children, and the weasel was hurting the children. And so Princess Betty called her guards and said, 'Bring that weasel before me.' And when the weasel was dragged into the courtroom, Princess Betty looked at him and said, 'Off with his head.'" Can you say that? Oh, I couldn't. Go ahead and try. Oh, well, off with his head. And everyone in the class just automatically echoed her and yelled, "Off with his!" And then we did the same thing for the grandfather, who was a snake, and the minister, who was a bear. A bear was holding the children. He was holding the children too tight, and he was pushing all the air out of them, and he scared the children, and he hurt the children. And Princess Betty had her guards bring that bear in. And she looked at that bear, and she said, "Off with his head." And by the third one, she was getting there. She goes, "Off with his head." And I said, "Well, let's go for gold." I said, "If your husband was an animal, what animal would he be?" And she said, "Fox." Well, Princess Betty heard that a fox was hurting the children. The fox was taking his tail, and he was slashing it against them. And Princess Betty called her guards and brought that fox into her great courtroom. And Princess, and I couldn't even finish the sentence, and Betty yelled out, "Off with his fucking head!" And we all exhaled. And she stopped smiling and got to work. So sometimes you need to make your own story. Sometimes you can help somebody make the story that just gets them centered where they need to be. But it's a very powerful process. So let's open it up. Press 6. And let's hear what you guys are thinking.
I love you. You're brilliant.
That was great, Judith.
So what are other people's experience? Huh? So you guys, what is your experience of creating stories from your life and helping other people do it?
Well, I always put myself in the third person.
Uh-huh.
Because I think it kind of removes myself from the situation, and I think it makes it a little more universal where other people could relate to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically, and I kind of do the same thing, and I kind of feel like I really, really want to learn a lot more from you, Judith, because that was basically what I want to do and why I'm in storytelling. This is Della, by the way.
Oh, good. Thank you. So. Yeah, identify yourself before you talk.
Yeah, sorry about that. But, yeah, this is exactly why I'm here and what I want to do with storytelling. So I thank you so much, and I want to learn more from you. So.
Yeah, I think everyone has, I mean, you know, when you say, I don't have any stories, are you kidding? We all do. It's just reauthoring them so other people can enter them. Who else?
It's funny, Judith. No. I've been working on a workshop that I call Restoring Our Lives.
Uh-huh. Who's this?
Rather than reauthoring. This is Sherry Lynn.
Hi, Sherry Lynn.
I've been recently, through some of my own experiences, I've been hanging out with some women who really need to be empowered.
Mm-hmm.
And who are going through transitions in their lives and have been, dealt with domestic violence, and I really want to work with them on restoring their lives and getting their power back and their voice back. I haven't done a lot of – I've done more work with developing my own stories and getting them to a point where I'm really at a place where I can safely share them. Because I know that the most important thing is to make sure that the audience is protected and sharing a story with them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious about that. These stories, when you're working with people to share their own stories and to get their own stories, how do you explain to them that this is great for here and now? If you ever want to share this in front of an audience, you need to get past... I don't even know how to explain it. How do you explain that to them?
What, the difference between therapy and story?
Yes.
That the raw experience is what you need to process. It's not what you share as a story. You know, the raw experience is what you're doing your homework with. But understanding why and how it affected you, that's the story. So it's almost standing outside of it and coming to understand what it meant in the larger scope of your life. And then there are lots of different ways to start to do that.
Mm.
Was that clear?
Yes.
That what happened to you is your experience, but the story is something else.
Right.
Yeah.
And most of these women that you work with, say, at Lesley College,
mm-hmm.
Do they ever go and share their stories
elsewhere? No, I mean, these are teachers. You know, these are people who all the rest of the time in the class were doing how to use storytelling to extend curricular, cognitive, social, emotional objectives in the classroom. And I just add this on because I want them to have some chance to do personal development. Because, you know, it's like sitting in the theater and the box opening up. If we don't deal with our personal issues, they will deal with us. You know, they will come back and invade us at the most inappropriate times.
Okay.
So it's just, I mean, it's just a wonderful way of dealing with those things. And not
was that,
dealing. What?
Was that Sherry Lynn? Was that who was just talking about domestic violence?
Sherry
yes.
Lynn, who's working with the women who are domestic violence.
Sherry Lynn, I do the same kind of work. This is Bella again.
Oh, hi, Bella.
And I would like you to contact me. Because I think we can collaborate on some brainstorming and some ideas and stuff. So.
Oh, good.
Okay. What's your last name, Della?
McGuire. And once the HSA website is reissued, it's still in the works now. You can get my contact information from there. I'm on the executive committee as of a few months ago. So I'd like to work with you on some stuff.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, thanks.
Nice.
Judith.
If they don't come,
hello?
I continue to yammer.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, it's Carolyn.
Hello, Carolyn.
Hi, Judith. Yeah, I was just going to listen, but that story about the woman, you know, and the bear and that woman in your class.
Uh-huh.
And you do that as like one class or one section of a storytelling unit where you're using stories in the classroom and all of that stuff, and then you do this one unit. So that woman opened
no, that woman
up
came
something
to my home
that
to study
she kept
storytelling
closed for years. Then where does she go with that, Judith?
Well,
I mean, that's scary to me. I wouldn't know. I mean, where does she go with something that she's been able effectively to hide under a little smile for most of her life, and then all of a sudden it erupts?
Well, she came to study in my home for a weekend. So
she
chose to be here. It was something she was ready to
work on. Oh, that was
on.
The weekend. Oh, I'm
right.
Sorry. That's right.
So she came for the weekend. She was, you know, she wanted to work on this. I think she just didn't know the way in. And when she left a much happier woman.
She did?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, if you had buried rage, wouldn't you feel better if you'd learned how to express it?
I would. I would. I don't know that I would be able to handle it the way you handled it, that you were able to make a story out of it and you were able to help her work with it. I think you have to be you, someone as experienced as you, to have people reveal those kinds of stories.
Well,
I mean, those are deep stories. That,
well, right. This, you know, this
I'm not, I wasn't even going to speak about this. I don't think I would be able to handle personal stories like that that came from the audience. I'm going to mute myself now because I don't want to talk anymore.
Oh.
Sorry. I'm just looking at my own, I think, inadequacy in dealing with people's stories like that. But you can do it. I'm muting now. Bye.
Okay, well, it's not your job. That was my job. It's not your job.
No, but when it comes up, though, like that. So she had a weekend to work on that.
Yeah.
Work on the stories. I was thinking she was in your class.
Nah.
Okay, bye.
Nah, you're much gentler when you're only, when you know that you're not going to have time to do follow-up with somebody.
Yes, okay. All right.
You know, this is Joe Doolittle, by the way, and I really appreciate the structure and the method because... And the stories have been great, and the method has been great. But my experience in some of my volunteer work as a chaplain is that I often get called, like I've just finished a night of on-call at the Albany Medical Center. And, you know, at 2:30 in the morning, you wind up with a patient who's expiring and a family and a room full of people standing, sneezing and crying.
Mm-hmm.
And when you come in, you don't know any of them.
Right.
And they expect something. And I've come to the point where I know that something's going to happen, and my faith tells me that it'll be good. And you have to establish a relationship and a presence. And invariably, I look for the relationship in, you know, after some, tell me something, you know, whatever. Tell me a story about, you know, something this woman or person did who was kind. How did you
right.
know she was kind and loved you? And, you know, they look at first a little bit, but in that pain and angst, you know, things bubble up.
Yeah.
And you can encourage them to share the story. And what I've come to do, and last night the daughter of this woman who's about 25, mimicked her with the look of the mother, you know, the smirk and the rolling the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And she did it just like her, and everybody just roared. And right there, the whole tragedy got wings. And you know, you couldn't let it go, but I kind of facilitated it and reminded them that, you know, in the morning they were going to be faced with doing play of a memorial service or whatever, and the process of pulling these stories out so they could hold to the memory.
Well, you did this gentle thing from mourning death. You took them from mourning death to celebrating life.
Well, you know, one of the lines that came out of my mouth, and I was telling my wife, when I got home, there was a lot of tears, and let the tears flow, because the tears are actually the equivalent of a standing ovation for your mother.
Oh.
I'm not a poet, but that one came out. And they all, and there was laughter.
Yeah.
So I guess my point is that the structure's helped, because you also added a, I mean, I've lost my own mom and parents and siblings, so you kind of share that, not to take the stage, but to build a relationship. And it really works. And last night I had one of the best thanks-yous I've ever had. I had left the room and was standing with one of the doctors, and the husband came out, and he looked at me, and I didn't know what he was going to say, and he came over to me, and he told me two bad jokes, and we laughed. And he said, we appreciated you being with us, and I think we know how to make ourselves laugh through the tears, through the standing ovation. Thank you. And I've never had that experience before. And I'm not, and I'm reflecting, I'm not, you know, I know I'm not looking for a pat on the backs, but again, the ability to let the story come out. Because I think one of the things that brings the story out is just that pregnant pause where you don't say anything, so they have to say something.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the pain is right there, so they're, you know, it's going to bubble up. And so, I mean, it's very fresh with me, and I always have choir on Thursday nights, so I've never, we're finished for the summer, so I could get on these calls, and it's been great. Thank you.
You know, and Caroline, there's something that Joe said, and he didn't use this word, but he trusted his guidance. I don't know any other way to put it.
Yeah.
That sometimes when you're in situations like that, you just exhale and you pray to whatever higher being you believe in to help you, you know, to help those people bridge that place from death back to life.
And prayer is part of it, because one of the other problems you have in that situation as the chaplain is you don't know this person. You don't know this family. So how do you really pray with them? So you have to have the stories bubble up so you can weave their own language into a prayer. And that's the dilemma I had, because I had a hard time praying with people cold. And so there's actually a harvest of the stories from the standpoint of the storyteller. And what I've tried to do is give them the encouragement to keep it going, because...
And the term prayer is very loaded.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so...
Oh, yeah.
But story isn't. So, you know, that puts you also in a more shared and safer territory.
I had a woman one day, the nurse had told me about the problem. She wasn't really identifying with the fact that her husband was dying, and the nurse's opinion, you want to go see your chaplain. And so she walked in to tell the woman, the wife, that the chaplain was there, and I was standing in the doorway, and she was behind the screen.
Hello?
And I hear this voice say, I don't want to talk with the fucking chaplain. Oh, shit.
And you go, here I am, I'm the fucking chaplain.
That's exactly what I said.
Yeah.
And he looked at me, and the nurse was big-eyed, and I was a little bit nervous, so I actually pulled a chair over in the middle of the, between the room, and there's a big hall, and we sat in the middle of the hall, because I didn't know what she was going to do, really.
Uh-huh.
And we had a very quiet conversation there for about 40 minutes, and I won't give you all of it, but she turned out to be an alcoholic. Actually, I got involved with the family and got her into AA after the whole thing was resolved with her husband, but... You know, you never know, and that, I've never had anybody say that. I don't want to talk to a fucking chaplain. So, you know, you run into all sorts. But again, it was the eliciting of the story, and it was the listening to it, and it was the ability to then reflect back. And I couldn't pray because she was not a believer, but to reflect back to her.
Thank you.
Powerful stuff. You know, you're doing great work, you guys. I'm really impressed.
What's your name?
Oh, my name's Joe Doolittle, and
you're Joe Doolittle. Okay, I didn't say your name.
Near Albany,
Okay.
I'm in Lanes, and...
And I know who you are now that you say your name.
Hi, Joe. I appreciated what you shared. Sherry Lynn.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
We all kind of know each other. It's great.
Yeah, well... It's sometimes hard to develop a program around personal stories because I do a lot of it, and I find that the best ones that come to me since I've had grandchildren are around my grandkids
because
they're just fountains of material. You know? And
Also, it's far enough away from yourself that it's easier to work on. You know, it's sort of like you don't have to do any less. Actually, when you're creating stories from your own life, it's more work than shaping fairy or folktales or history because you got to get yourself out of the way.
Right.
You know, so it's even more work. Are you guys interested in some technical ways of doing this?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I have four models that I use for working on personal stories. Just, I bet there are millions of ways to do this. These are just some of the ways I've come up with. But the easiest is framing. And framing is you have an experience, and then you frame it in the reason you want to tell it or why it has resonance for you. So, por ejemplo, let's say that as a 14-year-old, your mother was a firstborn immigrant child. They tend to be very A-type personalities because they're people who have fought their entire lives and they're going to fight your entire life. They just never had a chance to stop and they don't. So let's say you just turned 14 and you're getting on a bus in New York City with your mother and you know that buses require exact change and you say, Mom, I'm just going to go over there and get change. And she goes, no, it's all right. We're just going to get on the bus. It's fine. But, Mom, I don't have to. It's going to be fine. Now, come on. Here's the bus. And your mother drags. And then in a voice as loud as the announcer at Yankee Stadium, she says, who has change? I have a 5 and I need change. And after she haggles and runs up and down the aisle and makes change and finally gives it, she comes back and sits next to you and tears are pouring down your eyes. Just pouring. And she goes, what's wrong with you? We're on the bus, aren't we? This would be an experience you might not forget.
Yeah.
Right.
And it might be one you tell over and over and over again by way of demonstrating what a hideous mother you have and how embarrassed you were. Now, but it's just, that's an anecdote. That's not a story. So one of the simplest ways to make story from it is frame it in meaning. So why?
Frame it in what?
In meaning.
Why did that
experience resonate for you? What does it mean? You could tell it just to prove that you have a right to hate your mother. I have a right to hate my mother, and let me tell you why. The whole experience. See? Don't I have a right? So you could just do it to prove your own biases. Or you might decide that you tell that story to demonstrate that you need, even with some of your closest relations, to have limits. And you might start by saying, you know, we all have relatives. We love them. But some of them are best visited within the confines of your or their home. Unfortunately, some of them are our primary relationships. And then you would tell that anecdote. Okay, I love her, but traveling together is one thing we do not do. And by framing it in that, one, you give other people the power not to just feel that they hate their mother, but to do something about that part of their mother. Because you usually never hate your whole mother. You just hate that part of her that humiliated you. So you're identifying that part, and you're taking charge of it by limiting its effect in your life. So you are no longer just reliving that. You're actually taking charge. And there are so many reasons that you might tell that story. You might... Let's say you're somebody who really, you don't like showy people. You don't like loud people. All your life, you have spent your time staying away from them, making judgment. When you're at work and somebody who's like, you know, woohoo, a peacock, who's loud or showy, you find that you're trying to avoid them. And by 35, you are so busy trying to avoid these people, you're like a mouse in your own life. And it's just not working. And you realize that this is the reason. The reason is they remind you of your mother, and you don't ever want that to happen again. So you might frame your story like this. You know, every time I'm working with a new group of people at work or socially, I get headache-producing red flags around the big ones. I don't mean physically big, but people that take up a lot of psychic space, if you know what I mean, the loud ones, the showy ones, the shameless peacocks, those who like to own the group with their opinions. I mean, For 15 years of my life, I've worked to place myself in situations where I will not have to deal with these giant vacuum cleaner people. And now at 35, I feel like a mouse, constantly hiding in a world of cats. Well, I'm getting tired of hiding. I'm even getting tired of my own outrage. And I wonder where it started. Huh. I think where all things do, when you were a kid. And then I might add a few other anecdotes about the mother, you know, and the mother's dominance and bigness, and end with that anecdote about the bus. And then, huh, was every big person in my world my mother? Maybe it's time to expand my repertoire of friends. So just even the idea of understanding how that relationship has affected who you are now and wanting to reevaluate it puts it in a frame. It changes it. And it takes you out of just suffering from that experience to being ready to use it as a springboard to go somewhere else. Or maybe finally, here's one more. As a child, I was like a poorly rooted seedling in a storm. There were 7 of us, children of immigrant parents who were survivors. They were burnt cedars in a forest that did not survive. There was little time for puttering around small roots. And then I would put in the story about the bus. My roots had to get stronger, or they'd be given up to the harsher winds of this world. You know, ultimately, I have that embarrassing woman to thank for those stronger roots. Mm-hmm. So by just creating a frame with your understanding of how an experience has touched you, you make it into story and you make it accessible to others to identify with. Mm-hmm. And you take it just out of your own embarrassing past. So that's one very simple way of dealing with personal experience. I just call that framing. Any thoughts about that?
That's fabulous. It's fabulous. Mm. It really is, because it allows you to, just what you said, to take an experience that by itself is just kretching, but if you put it in a larger framework, then you can make it funny, or you can make it something that taught you a lesson or made you who you are today. Or I love it. That's a great thing. That's a great technique. Thank you.
It's a quickie. It's one any of you can use. And the others, I know our time's going to go. I wrote an article on this, and if anybody would like me to send it to them, you can just write to me, and I will send
great.
It.
Oh, great. Okay.
It's called Stories Born of Real Life. I have 3 other models. And,
okay.
You know, one's called Finding the Heart of a Single Experience. How do you cull through an experience that's touched you, understand why, and then shape the details, the trajectory, and the characters to reflect that reason so that you can create a really rich and powerful story. Because something happens that has a profound impact on you, and you know it needs to be a story, but how do you go from the experience to the story? And I had this great friend, may she rest in peace, died a few years ago, Sarah Wernick, a great writer. And Sarah I always used to go to her when I was working on something new, and she'd always say, Judith, just because it happened doesn't mean it belongs in the story.
Yeah. You said that to me once, Judith. You said that's a lovely thing, but it doesn't go in this story.
Right.
Yes. And it was hard for me to take it out because I really liked it. But
And if it doesn't have to do with your reason for telling it, it doesn't belong there. So, you know, just reshaping experience. Once you know why something's touched you, you can go back through it and say, this belongs. Oh, this needs some support material. This needs something else in there. Just because it happened doesn't mean it belongs in the story if it doesn't have to do with your reason for telling it and what you hope will resonate with others. And that's a very hard thing to do because, you love your stuff. You go, but wait, that's so cute, or you know, or that's stunning. I was working on this story. I think it was Looking for God's Doorbell. Story about my son becoming a bar mitzvah. It was like pushing a fat drunk up a narrow flight of stairs. It was one of the hardest things to ever get him to do. But we did it. And as part of the story, I'd written about my neighbor, who, a very nice guy, who had he grabbed the leaves before they hit the earth. He mowed 3 times a week. He clipped his bushes twice a week. Mm. He was a slight bit compulsive. And my yard looks like upstate New Hampshire. So, you know, we'd always kind of like give each other the hairy eyeball. And he was so nice to my son. He, because I raised him alone, I didn't know how to tie a tie. He taught him how to tie a tie. You know, he taught him how to throw a fastball. He changed things in his life, and I really wanted to write about him, but it didn't belong in that story. And it ended up being its own short story that was just stunning. So sometimes you have something and you go, oh, it doesn't belong there, but keep it in your pocket because it'll go somewhere else, you know, and it. So, you know, it's not like nothing is ever lost. Sometimes it just doesn't fit.
Hmm. Hi, Judith.
Hi.
This is Pat.
Who's that?
Spaulding.
Hi.
Pat Spaulding. Hi.
Oh, have you been here the whole time?
Nope, I just got in really late, so
oh.
I just called the number to see if it would work, and it worked.
Hi, Pat. We're all here. There's a gang of us. This is what Pat does also, and she does it wonderfully.
Thanks. Except I don't. Showing up on time is not my forte. It's not
well,
my
there
fault.
You go.
I think we recorded it, so it might be on the Healing website sometime.
Oh, okay.
Coming up. So,
so finding the heart in a single experience is another another model. Hey, why don't I? I have about 5 minutes, right?
Yep.
Keep okay. going.
So, would you like to hear? Okay. So, something happened in our town that resonated. A fellow named Chris Piper was killed in Afghanistan. And, you know, people said, did you know Chris? And at first I thought, nah, I don't know him. But then you realize I live in like this little town. It's called Marblehead. It's a finger sticking out into the ocean. And if you don't know somebody, you know somebody who knows them. And it turns out I really did know him. And when someone in your town dies, it doesn't matter whether you believe in the cause or not. Everybody just kind of circles the wagons. And when it came time for his funeral, well, it became a frigging zoo. All the politicians who were running for president were going to come to town because they wanted to be seen at a military funeral. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the whole town was going to be there. And then we heard that this fellow, Reverend Fred Phelps, was going to come from the Westboro Baptist Church. Have any of you ever heard of him?
Oh, yeah. He's mm-hmm. the guy that's anti-gay.
Right.
Yeah,
and
he came to Albany too. What a disgusting process!
Oh my
Go
God!
Ahead.
So, Fred Phelps was going to be protesting right next to the church, where everybody was going to be walking in with signs like "Fag in a Bag," "God Hates Americans," another roadside explosive device success story. I mean, horrible.
Good grief!
And then, on the day of the funeral, I mean, everybody was here. Who shows up? Hell's Angels show up. Mm. I mean, it was just the most amazing experience. And it kept resonating in my brain. And I thought, this is a story. But what is it a story about? Now, it could have been a story about the stupid behavior of politicians. It could be about burying your dead. It could have been because my son was an active Marine at that time fighting the same war. It could have been, again, about, you know, my mother's angst. It could have been about many, many things. But I worked on this thing called an emotional map, which is working in color and texture and shape and just drawing without words about an experience to try to figure out what it means to you. And when it emerged, I saw, you know, these sad figures in the middle and these soft figures around them and then these other soft figures supporting them and then these two hard, dark, black things invading the soft piece of the town. And it was Reverend Fred Phelps and it was the Hell's Angels. And they played absolutely opposite roles. Oh, God, I don't have time to tell you the story. I'm going to get through it real fast. Okay. So Reverend Fred Phelps, they go all over the country, and they say, God is going to punish you because God knows you are Sabbath breakers. God knows you are adulterers. But more important than anything else, God knows that you are supporting homosexuality. And so Fred Phelps and his minions go all over the country, anywhere where homosexuality is mentioned is a normal, acceptable thing, and they protest high school graduations, military funerals, everything with those signs I told you about. Well, they're angels. Yes. Well, there are two kinds of angels. You know, there's your vengeful angel, and that was Fred Phelps, and then there's your protective angel. Yeah. In our town, if you don't know somebody, you know somebody who knows them. So when people said, "Do you know Chris Piper?" I thought, "No, Oh, God, yes. His son is in a program I run called Bridging Lives. He's a little redheaded kid who keeps kicking his big brother in the balls. Oh, and I know his ex-wife, Connie. She runs a resale show. Oh, my God, and my friend Carl was married to his sister. Yeah, of course I know the family. Well, his protective angel slept in too late on a day in July, and he was killed with two other men by a roadside device. And the whole town circled the wagons. I mean, he knew the job was dangerous, but it still doesn't make it any easier for Connie or for Chris Jr. or for his father or for all the people who loved him who now have a hole in their lives. And so we baked casseroles and we helped plan the funeral, and his whole unit was going to come and bury him. And then we heard that Reverend Fred Phelps was coming. Well, the police met, and they're not allowed to intimidate. You know, it goes against First Amendment rights. But they got the police. There's this great police bagpipe band, and they decided they'd bring them in so at least nobody could hear their chanting. And so the police bagpipe band was going to be there. We were going to come marching through, and any time they started those hateful chants, fag in a bag, roadside device success, they would just, you know, start to play. Mm. And on the day of the funeral, with hundreds of people waiting to process a quarter mile down through Old Town Marblehead, the earth shook. I mean, literally shook, and a black cloud came riding through the town, and it stopped at the Five Corners, and when the dust settled, Hell's Angels? And then they moved their hogs right up Pleasant Street, around the corner, past the police barriers, parked them, and got off. One guy, he got off his hog, and there on the back of his jacket, it said Blackstone Valley Veterans.
Yes.
Another guy came off, and he was as skinny as the day is long, with his few teeth stained from tea and cigarettes. And right on his knuckles, he had tattooed VIETNAM.
Oh, wow.
A third biker got off. And he was so big, you couldn't tell the difference between his neck and shoulders. And when he took off his helmet, their buzz cut in his head was the word vet. And these guys walked over to the Westboro protesters. And let me tell you, they have PhDs in intimidation. They put the children and women in the front row thinking people wouldn't whack them. And it was the kids that broke down first. Mommy! Mommy! And like a balloon losing air, the kids curled in on their mothers, and the mothers curled back towards the men. And as the bikers started literally snorting at them, their signs went down, and they went running to the white van where Reverend Fred Phelps waited for them. And it headed out of town. Just as the funeral procession approached, and every one of those bikers turned, and in a single, smooth movement, took a military stance. Fingers to their foreheads. At attention. As that casket with the flag over it and soldiers in full blue on all sides of it processed by them. And they did not relax until the entire family had entered that church and could bury their dead in peace. And then each man got back on his hog, fired it up, and headed out of town. And in that great cloud of dust, I wondered, huh, you know, you never know what your angels are going to look like.
Beautiful, Terry.
Oh, that's great.
So when you're working on these, you say, what I mean, it could be about so many things, but then it's muddy. Why does it speak to you here and now? And it might change in 10 years, and then your story will change. But making that choice enables you to shape it for other listeners. I know
I think
we've got
to need a part two. We need another night.
Yeah.
This was so wonderful.
Yeah, really, it was great.
It sounds
Thank
like people
so
can
much.
Write you to get the article if they want.
Right, I'm JB at storiesalive.com.
What should they ask for?
Stories from real life, article stories from real life. And if anyone's interested in taking the class, it's called Making Stories from Your Life. It's the first weekend in February. We have an incredible time. And I bake a lot. I love to bake.
We also have high hopes, unless she gets a bigger gig, that Judith is going to be the MC at the Saturday night Healing Story concert during the Healing Story Conference that's happening the last weekend in June in Massachusetts.
Yay!
Come
I'm
and join us for an
that.
Evening
I'm,
of story with Judith leading the crowd.
Well, it looks like a great program. I circulated widely over to the folks that I know on this side of the border that I think would be interesting, but we're going to be away out of the country, so bummer.
With you. So thank you, Judith, so much, and we would love to have you come back, and I think everyone here would be there again, and we'd probably grow the crowds double. So
thank you for this opportunity, and thank you everybody who called.
Yeah, thank you. It was wonderful.
Hi, Caroline, Ava, Andy, Norris,
and
Casey,
it has been recorded, so you'll be able to hear it again and revisit it soon on the Healing Story website.
Janet.
So thank you all, and have a lovely night.
Thank you.
You
good
too.
Night.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Night.
Good
night.
Thank you all. Thank you.